Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And today is the anniversary of the death of one of the greats in theology, the father of Black liberation theology, Dr. James Howe Cone. Mm. He transitioned last year, April 28th, 2018.
Okay.
So, we're talking about James Cone and his life and his impact and what he has meant to not just theology in the academic circles, but also his legacy reverberates throughout Black churches and just spaces where you find Black people considering faith. It doesn't necessarily mean Christian, but James Cone was a giant, and so we're talking about him today. James Cone, born August 5th, 1936 in Fordyce, Arkansas. He grew up in Bearden, though. So the thing about James Cone being born in 36 in Arkansas, he saw a lot of lynchings. Mm. This was a tough thing for a child to see. He was very aware of it. And as you can imagine, a child would be when they're seeing things like that. I was actually just reading the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, and he spoke of something similar as he saw a slave, a woman who was stripped bare and beaten, and he was a child. I think he was six at the time, and that was so traumatic that it just scarred him for the rest of his life.
Yeah, so we don't usually, I don't think a lot of historical writings called those things what they really were. It was just terrorism. It was meant and designed to instill that level of fear in whomever was going to witness it. So it's not unheard of for children to carry those scars. And as we know now, you know, like we talk about things in present terms about violence perpetuated by the state or actions and policies that harm children and families. And now there's dialogue about, oh, this will harm the child for the duration of their life. This will, you know, totally change how they process information or how they conduct their own behavior. It's not much different from the things that our elders survived in their own environments. But I'm glad the writings and the discussions are happening now, because minds like ours can take that information and apply it to previous generations and say there's nothing different.
Yeah, it's not. When I think about the terrorism, that is terrifying and traumatic for an adult. For a child, I just can't imagine. And I try to get into the head of when I read accounts like this, I try to get into the mind of a child. What would they think going through something like children? If I raise my voice too loud, sometimes the children are scared, and I gotta, you know, soothe them and make sure they know, you know, daddy still loves them, stuff like that. But to see another human being that you see walking around, you know, maybe you know them and you've spoken to them maybe recently that same day, to see them lynched is an incredible, horrific event that, that no one should ever witness, least of all a child.
Pure evil.
So he's in the South. He actually excels as a student throughout his formative education. He goes to two HBCUs that do not exist anymore. So this is Shorter College and Philander Smith. He did well at the schools. And after those HBCUs, it's right around Brown versus Board of Education.
Right.
Prior to Brown v. Board.
Plessy is the law of the land, which enshrines separate but equal, which spawns Jim Crow. So in this environment where it's appropriate that we're talking about a Black scholar attending an HBCU, pop culture has kind of been celebrating HBCU traditions in the past couple weeks with Beyonce's release of the homecoming video and Coachella CD and all of this. But at one point in time, our schools were the doors that were open to us.
Yeah, the only doors.
Pretty much the only doors. You did have some schools like Oberlin College, I believe it's in Ohio, that did not make a habit of taking Black students, but definitely did take Black students prior to 1954. But it's important to know that that tradition of nurturing Black scholarship is strong at schools that were serving Black students.
One of the impacts of Brown versus Board is the indictment that Plessy versus Ferguson's separate but equal was not equal, which meant the education that everyone was receiving, black people were receiving, was not equal to what whites were receiving. So as Cone is being educated and excelling, mm-hmm. what happens when he gets to Garrett, he realizes that even though he was a good student, he was deficient in terms of reading, writing, and he had to do a lot of work while he's doing his coursework to actually come up to the standard for the school.
Mm-hmm.
Nick Cone did it, but not everyone would be able to do it just because of the time that it takes. Cone was spending large amounts of time after school throughout the evenings just working to get his writing to a baseline level.
Right.
For
a graduate student.
Yeah, because he was mm-hmm. a C student going, I mean, he was an A student going in, and then he was struggling to make a C student.
This is still happening.
Yeah.
Students who are going to underserved schools. We talk about it and we see this all the time. We see it in different jurisdictions. You know, I'm in Baltimore City and our schools are constantly under critique for what they do and what they don't do. But this lingering idea of purposely underserving or under equipping certain schools to facilitate the education of students. It hasn't stopped. And when students enter into college, again, sometimes the value of the HBCU is that recognition of the gap and training you up while you're at school to meet the level that will come after the HBCU. Yeah. So at least that was my experience. We had a rigorous training to prepare us to not, it was almost like being sent out and saying, don't embarrass me.
Yeah.
We had those types of professors. Don't embarrass me when you go to Maryland. Don't embarrass me when you go wherever you're going.
Right.
Who really focused on our writing and our critical thinking skills, mainly just to see what gaps were there and close them and overcome them. You know, I think we, you know, I love my schools, but I think there's something to be said about institutions that train you up and get you ready for what's outside of their doors. Hmm. So.
I miss that experience. I want that experience, but okay. There's still time.
There's still time.
So he gets his MDiv 1961, then heads off to Northwestern. Now, what's happening during this time
mm-hmm.
is the civil rights movement in the United States. So he's in school and he's reading European theologians. So, mm-hmm. I mean, he is all of these theological giants that he's reading, and there's nothing that looks like him.
Right.
And he's talking through different aspects of what God means. What does the justice of God mean? And while he's doing this, he writes in his first book, right outside his window, basically is, you know, people marching for civil rights, his people outside marching. And he realizes that the theology that he's studying does not speak to the reality that he's living. And so he has people like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X now, two giants that he's being influenced by because he's hearing
contemporaries.
Them, and they're both speaking to things that matter to Cone. So Martin is speaking the language of theology that he understands from his time at Garrett.
Mm-hmm.
Malcolm is speaking the language of black liberation, yep. which he understands from growing up in Arkansas and seeing what that was like and why that's needed.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then he also has Baldwin also in the background working. So these three influences cause Cone at some point to get angry.
Mm-hmm.
And his idea is that 2,000 years of European theology, and you're missing this liberation idea, this idea that Jesus liberates, that what Jesus came to do was to liberate. And this started with the story of the Exodus, the Hebrews out of slavery out of
mm-hmm.
Egypt. And he's putting together all of this stuff, and he writes this when he I was talking to a professor of mine who's a student of Cone, and he's relaying this story that Cone was so upset when he wrote Black Theology and Black Power, which is his first book.
Okay.
He just went up and was writing from like 5 a.m. to 7 p.m.
Anger and pain will do it to you.
Yeah, I think he did that for 5 months. Came out with this book that was a theological meteor
mm-hmm.
that struck.
Turned it right on its ear.
Right. And so this is a new idea that people had not encountered before. Mm-hmm. And that is this idea that Jesus didn't just come to save you for eternity. Jesus came to liberate you now. There's no point of going for eternity if you don't address what's happening now. And exactly. Why would you say, I'll let you suffer now and just take care of it on the back end? Kona's like, no, that is a useless gospel.
It's a perfect storm in that you have an ongoing civil rights movement and you have the emergence of strong voices, not unlike Martin, that are willing to ask those hard questions to both bodies that are dealing with faith and bodies that are dealing with politics and culture. Mm-hmm. Those things colliding create space for the meteor. Mm-hmm. Because it's like a marketplace of ideas. So now imagine you were going to a restaurant and all they served was fried chicken. That's it. All I'm serving is fried chicken. You know what you're going to get when you come here.
That's funny. That's exactly what happened on the show this week. But okay, go ahead.
But you go in one day and they actually have a full buffet set up. Mm-hmm. And you didn't even know that you liked, you know, green beans. You didn't know that you liked asparagus. You didn't realize that, again, the intellectual food is medicine. If I dine on Baldwin, it'll take me closer to what I'm feeling on the inside, but I haven't really had an opportunity to articulate. So sometimes we talk about things and I don't want people to think that these things are happening independent of one another. They're actually interdependent. When we talked about Martin before, we've talked about Malcolm earlier in these episodes this season. And hopefully what I hope our audience is starting to do is see the masterpiece, the
formation.
Yeah. Of this bigger picture that fills in the blank, you know, how did we get here? Mm-hmm. So Cone is a huge part of that.
Yeah. So as in Black Theology, Black Power, not only is Cone addressing theological issues, he's also addressing anthropological issues. So he's questioning those who would sit in an academic university about and study God, but not see this. Like, how could you not see this after all this time? Are you this blind to the truth of liberation that you just cannot understand that the Hebrews were liberated from slavery? Black people are still working their way from slavery to liberate themselves. In the wilderness. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no one's made this connection before. He was like, how dare you sit here and
I think it's anti-intellectual. I think that's what a good researcher will call out. They will present you with data and write everything but the conclusion. They will say, now, what did you come up with? And the truth of the matter is we talk about supremacist structures, formal and informal, and the formal and intentional supremacist environments that we find in our educational facilities and our educational institutions is designed that way. So here he comes with this book that says, for lack of a better phrase, y'all tried it. Mm-hmm. There's no way that you could gift wrap an oppressive God to us and oppress people that never finishes what he starts, never delivers what he's promised. It's disingenuous at best. It's evil at its worst.
Cone is saying, how dare you attempt to cast yourself in the role of God's people, the chosen Israel,
when you've never been oppressed.
We've never been oppressed. Mm-hmm. Not only are you not Israel, in that story, you're Egypt. Mm-hmm. In Jesus's story, you're Rome.
So you tried it.
Right. And so that's the reason why I hit so hard, because he's asking tough questions. He's saying, if you as a white Christian care about eliminating evil, then would you eliminate those who practice and perpetuate evil? Why would you not do that? The fact that you don't suggests that you value that solidarity with those people that look like you over the actual justice.
Now, keep in mind, he wrote this in the 60s. Mm-hmm. We find ourselves asking this question in the evolution of our body politic over the last, let's say, 8 years or so. Not just 2016, but even the immediate knee-jerk reactions to different changes, different leadership. And it really forced the question, Are you here because you are truly this Christian conservative, or does Christian conservatism take you closer to your overall goal of maintaining the status quo? Mm-hmm. This is the same thing that we're asking.
It also highlighted how divorced theology, and in this case, the adjective that goes in front of every form of theology, but what we're talking about, white is the adjective in front of theology here, how, or European. Mm-hmm. How divorced Eurocentric theology mm-hmm. was from what was going on. Conan's not the first person writing about this.
Not at all.
You have liberators all over the globe. So you have Patrice Lumumba, you have Frantz Fanon, you have County Cullen, you have all of these people. You mm-hmm. have James Baldwin.
Yeah.
Langston Hughes, you got Zora Neale Hurston, you got all of these people writing, and he's packaging their ideas in a theological framework, and now they're starting
so
to
so that
hear.
You cannot dismiss it under art.
Right.
Yeah.
So the fact that they didn't, that they're not familiar with these critiques means they haven't read any of this body
that they
work.
Immediately dismiss them.
So Black liberation theology is Cone's idea that God is a God of liberation. Okay. Mm-hmm. This challenged everyone's concept of God. So right now in the year 2019, we're like, okay, of course, God liberates.
Yeah,
that was not the way it was when Cone was writing it. This, you got, it's hard to imagine. It's hard for me to imagine a world where that was not the case. Actually, no, because no. I grew up in situations where liberation was not at the forefront of the discussion.
So it's not that liberation was not coming up. You know, as we discussed offline, Black liberation theology is a natural result across generations of probably what started out as revolutionary theory. Mm-hmm. Revolutionary theory has come to be defined as the voices that came together to critique the emerging country of the United States and its reliance on enslavement for its economy. As we, the long and the short of it is, how can you agitate for freedom as a colonial holding? How can you agitate for freedom from the King of England when you yourself are involved in holding others against their will? So think about it. Like, we talk about the Boston Tea Party. We talk about, was it Bacon's Rebellion, the Tax Act? These, and I'm trying to recall, but long story short, these were the offenses that colonists took as the crown taking too much of their power, too much of their money. And there's this groundswell to say, we're not even English anymore. We've been born here. You know, my father was born in America. I'm an American. And, or, at best, I'm not English. I wasn't born in England. Mm-hmm. I don't feel this attachment. So what is this new thing? And how much do I owe this entity? It led to a whole war. Mm-hmm. As those contemporary writers, and now we're talking about our founding fathers. So the George Washingtons of the world, the Thomas Jeffersons, the Adams son and father duo who ended up being presidents, all of that came together to critique this idea that we should remain under the auspices of England. At the same time, there was another groundswell. There was another voice that said, how are you agitating for this and you don't want this? Mm-hmm. Thomas Jefferson tried to acknowledge that in the Declaration of Independence. If anybody's seen the movie 1776, which is so boring, but I love it because I love history. Have you seen it before?
No. I'm not watching a movie in 1776.
Oh my God. It's a musical too. Like, it's really geeky, but I loved it. We had to watch it in class. But the point is, they do a great job of illustrating this. How do we come to a consensus to decide what the Declaration of Independence was going to say? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't know that South Carolina, the delegation from South Carolina, forced Thomas Jefferson, himself a slave owner, to exclude language from the final document mm-hmm. that tried to lay blame for slavery at the feet of the King of England. Really? They saw the problem with that. Exactly. So he had the foresight to know, and keep in mind, this is the president that we know has a whole Black family. Mm-hmm. So he was already kind of compromised, even though the movie did not make a big deal out of that mm-hmm. part. But the long and the short of it is they made him extract that language because they said that's problematic. Mm-hmm. They already knew that trying to keep slaves and yet be free and be this beacon of worldwide freedom, mm-hmm. for what they thought the world was not going to jive together for a long time. So it set us on this course. He excluded the language, but by the time we get to the Constitution, what ends up in the Constitution? The 3/5 compromise. Yeah. You don't want them to be free, but you want to have the congressional representation behind it. So it's just all of these different things. Mm-hmm. So it's not like Cone just woke up one day and said, I don't see no black people. There's been an intentional repression of this energy that says, if A, then why not be? Mm-hmm. And I really think his is a survey of all of the voices that, as I said before, could be dismissed as art. You're not going to read Zora Neale Hurston for a critique of theology, mm-hmm. if you are all automatically thinking of her as just some black woman writer,
right.
and you want to dismiss her as such. You're not going to think about Cullen. You're not going to think about Wright. You're not going to think about Langston Hughes. You're not going to look at them as a critique of this institution if immediately you like, they just some Negroes they're up in Harlem. Yeah, yeah, just chilling. But that's exactly what these writings were. And we finally, even at the time, at the turn of the 20th century, we finally had even more access and even more of a polished and refined voice to release all of that into the intellectual marketplace. So that's where Cone is operating.
So I want to talk a little bit about lament. So I read again the C.S. Lewis book called A Grief Observed. He wrote it right after his wife had died of cancer.
Okay.
And so C.S. Lewis, really not a theologian, but a brilliant writer. So he's writing this book and he's asking these really tough questions of God about, like, why would heaven be something else? Like, why would heaven be better? Or if heaven is better, then why are we here? Mm-hmm. Like, why would a God place us to live our lives here if, for instance, the blues were bluer in heaven? Mm. So he's asking really intelligent questions about death and suffering and things like that. Mm-hmm. And as I'm reading it, I'm also reading at the same time William Jones's, who was a critic of Cone's. His book is God a White Racist. So you juxtapose these two things. And so C.S. Lewis is...
I just heard what you said, like, whoa.
Yeah, okay. And so that was the intent. So Jones was a professor at Yale.
Okay.
Theologian. Brilliant. But he writes this book and it's... The title is jarring to a lot of people.
On purpose, though.
Right. And it puts people in a position where they say, I either agree or disagree with that.
Yeah.
The problem is both C.S. Lewis's book and William Jones's book are laments. They are experiencing trauma at the time of the writing. So mm-hmm. C.S. Lewis just lost his wife. William Jones is a black man living in America. Mm. And he's looking at the question of God from a racial lens because that's it's he was born in the 30s. He's growing into
that prevalent perspective.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. when lament is something that typically we allow for, but it makes us uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't want to look at it. We don't really know what to say. It's easier to look away. And then when you couch it as something that you can either agree or disagree with, like what Jones did, it's easy to dismiss it. What Cone is doing is also a lament through black theology, black power. It is an academically phrased lament, mm-hmm. just like Jones's book is. And so it's people can say, nah, I don't, you don't do that. If your partner dies,
mm-hmm.
you're going to say some things that people may or may not agree with, but the agreement is not the point.
Nope.
So,
but those things are profound. They right. won't come out if everybody's comfortable or everybody's feeling whole. Different things come out when you're going through different things. You know what I mean? Like your language will change. We said earlier, pain and anger will take you places that happiness just can't take you.
Right.
A lot of people use that as fuel to break a mold, like your mold is broken. So that makes sense. Once I question my position and get so uncomfortable with it that I must find either A or B, I got to get out of this place.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like you can recognize that in someone's output. You know, sometimes it is in their art. This is being offered under an academic, a high academic research based offering, but my output will change depending on what's going on
right.
inside of me.
also, over time, your ideas may change.
Yeah, and they'll evolve. You might dismiss
things. You may disagree with something that you said or verbalized in your lament. But that, again, the agreement isn't the point. Mm-hmm. The point is, it is in those times when your faith actually is working. It's easy to trust in God when nothing's going on. But when something is actually happening, then you're forced to ask some tough questions. Yeah. And that's the stretching of your faith. That is what Cone is doing through his Black liberation theology. Mm-hmm. And so he asks these questions. Then you have people who come and challenge Cone's position. Now, especially, I mentioned William Jones, who in some respects doesn't think Cone goes far enough.
Okay.
And in other aspects, he thinks Cone is too invested into the Black church. But one especially poignant critic of Cone is Dolores Williams. We spoke about her on the show in our
Black Woman surrogacy
suffering and
salvation. Yeah.
Basically, Williams's critique was, where are the Black women mm-hmm. in this liberation? Where do we fit in this movement? Because you've left us out of, we've been here the entire time, but you've left us out of how these things impact us.
Right.
Now, if the liberation is just for the Black men, then say so. But if you're saying it's for Black people, then we have something to say. And so Williams writes a book, and this is where it gets beautiful, because Cone writes Black Theology and Black Power. And then I believe right on the heels of that, as an answer, Williams writes Sisters in the Wilderness, which is a critique. Cone comes back in God of the Oppressed and acknowledges, affirms, and addresses the critique in a way that actually expands his view.
Mm-hmm.
So now we've entered into a dialogue between Black liberation theology and womanist theology.
Yes.
So this is how things should be working. Everyone comes up with an idea. Your idea ain't perfect.
Right, right.
And then when someone comes and says to you, hey, you may want to consider this, figure out how that makes your idea better instead of just rebutting and saying, nah, but I'm good. Here, I got it. You know, that's what people, nobody wants to be wrong or acknowledge right. that they can be better.
But Cone, I think
he does that throughout his books.
So the beauty is there. But let's also say that, again, this is not the first time that women are not a part of the conversation, even though they are doing a lot of the work. So in the civil rights movement writ large, you have women participating. You have women leading. You have women laying their lives on the line, putting their necks out there, risking their employment, risking their personal safety, but being relegated to a thank you maybe sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or, you know, go sit in the audience with everybody else while the men handle the business, conduct the affair, you know, are the public face. So this is not something that, again, was just happening as a manifestation of this being a conversation about theology and interacting or intersecting with churches. We had an issue right. with gender representation with the whole situation.
Yeah. I mean, there's no easy way to say this.
Mm-hmm.
Black men need to be reminded sometimes, hey, you're not the only voice in this one. Like, there's lots right. of people here.
Your mother would like to say something. Right.
So you start to get these critiques throughout Cone's his career.
Mm-hmm.
And he's refining his position or improving his position as he goes. And so as he gets to a point where he's now focusing on the cross and what Jesus did on the cross and how that liberates.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have another woman's critique that comes up and says, hey, do you realize when you say that Jesus did this thing on the cross, that you're saying there's nobility in suffering? That is something to be chased, to be attained. And that presents the message that, yeah, you can suffer, but there's going to be some good at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
To say that to Black women who have been receiving the brunt of the suffering, not just through slavery, but through sharecropping and through mm-hmm. all of these different points in history, you're saying, just keep suffering, God will redeem
it. It's gonna work out.
Yeah, that's a dangerous message.
Yeah.
And the critique also says, that's not the only message, that's not the only way to liberate. Like, liberation doesn't have to occur on the cross. If you look at the duration of Jesus's ministry, you have 3 years worth of liberation work there. Jesus was the example for liberation throughout his life. his death ends up being the penalty for the liberation work.
That he was doing.
This is what I love about theology. Like, this is where you start to get into conversations that really matter, and you start to think through some of this stuff. So what Cone did was start something, and then there became all of these branches, this dendritic tree of ideas, from womanist theology to echo theology to Native American theology to all of these different liberation fronts. You got queer theology. Everything branches off of Cone's liberation theology, because it is Cone that says God liberates.
Mm-hmm.
And once you say that, there's people who are experiencing various forms of oppression, mm-hmm, saying, does God liberate me?
Yes.
I love this. I'm so excited. So what is the legacy that we left with Cone? He goes on and he teaches for over 30 years, I believe, at Union Theological Seminary in New York. He does amazing work there in developing the next generation of theologian.
Mm-hmm.
Out of Cone's work and Cone's professional career as an academic, you get liberation theologians like Kelly Brown Douglas, who is now, she's a dean at Union.
Okay.
She wrote an amazing book called Stand Your Ground, Black Bodies and the Justice of God.
Mm.
And it starts off with a story about Trayvon Martin. And Kelly Brown Douglas is also writing, I think it's Black Sexuality. She writes, she's a brilliant theologian.
Okay.
You get Dwight Hopkins. You get a lot of just heavy hitters in theology coming from Cone, sitting in Cone's classes. And they end up shaping what we do as not only theologians, but as clergy. Now, here's the thing. A lot of clergy, they don't read academic theology.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll see Cone books on the shelves in the same way you'll see Baldwin books on the shelves, because mm-hmm, Cone had that type of reverberating impact in the world of theology and faith. And this was a big loss last year.
Mm-hmm.
Especially for me, like as I'm really getting started, like I really feel like I missed not learning about Cone, but the opportunity to meet Cone. So like I get into school and like I get all these opportunities to meet all these theologians doing all this work. And I'm like, yo, I read your book. Your book was amazing. Or, you know, I read your book. Did you think about this? Who am I? Some young podcaster.
Yes. Whatever.
But I never got a chance to talk to Cone. Like, and so that just made me want to just talk to everyone who's still here, because
his impact on you. You don't take it for granted.
Nah, these minds matter.
Yes, they do.
And while they're here, I want to engage them, whether it's through their work or in person or whatever. So, like, for instance, that's why I wanted to go to that Samuel DeWitt Proctor conference.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big deal. Kelly Brown Douglas was there this year,
and I
missed it. So I was upset about that, because I would have been like, oh, I read your books.
Right.
I wouldn't have had any critique.
Well, somebody's going to chase you down like that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Maybe. Yeah.
They will.
It's stuff on the way. So that is the late, great Dr. James Howell Cone, who left us April 28th last year. And so we just wanted to honor his memory, his legacy, his life's work, what that meant for us. You have probably been impacted by some Cone theology, even if they never said the name.
Mm-hmm.
Your pastors have probably, if they haven't read Cone, you may want to look for a new church, because
why are you there?
It matters. It matters that much.
Yes.
So for Faith Uncut, I'm your host Mike,
and I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.